Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we begin our 2010 election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. Let the other media obsess only on the horse race, like one candidate accusing the other of having no cojones, which seems to be the big New York State political story today. We will cover the horse race, too, in its place, but every weekday from now until the election, we will devote time to an issue and explore it in some detail. 30 issues in 30 days. We are also leaving our Friday segments in this series up to you from now through the election. We have a list of issues for you to vote on our New Politics website. It's afreecountry.org. Whichever gets the most votes in a given week will be our Friday topic. You can also nominate topics of your own. Go to itsafreecountry.org and vote on an issue that you want discussed. Our 30 issues series this year will take your issues up on Fridays. Also, this will be a series of true or false propositions this year. So let's begin with issue number one, true or false, a tax on the wealthy is a tax on small business. That's a central Republican argument against repealing the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%. Even if the cut expires, only for people making $250,000 a year or more, even if it only expires on that portion of the income that exceeds $250,000, which is the Obama plan, it would be a job-killing tax on small business, goes the argument. This is an issue of almost a complete partisan divide, so we don't even need to name particular congressional candidates or Senate candidates in our area. Almost all Republicans running for Congress support the Bush tax cuts on the top 2%. The vast majority of Democrats oppose them, so we will get two views. Later, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, but first, Bill Risch, tax counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business, a lobby group representing small businesses. Mr. Risch, thanks so much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thanks for having me.
So the argument makes it sound like even though the tax is on the top 2% of individual earners, that small business enters the equation. Make the argument. Is it simply that small business owners are many of the people who are doing that well?
Could you say that again? It cut out there for a second. I apologize.
Sure. When we talk about the Bush tax cuts and letting them expire, that would raise taxes on the top 2% of individuals. So my question is, where does small business come into it? Is it simply that small business owners are many of the people who are doing that well?
Well, about 75% of small businesses are structured in a way that they pay their tax on their business income at the individual level. They're what's called a pass-through business, S-corps, LLCs, a small number of partnerships, and really, even smaller firms sometimes are organized as sole proprietors. So the individual income tax rate is especially important for the vast majority of small businesses relative to the tax they pay on their business tax. So the expiration of the current tax rates does have a big impact on small business owners.
An analysis in the New York Times business section on Saturday, in which you were quoted, was headlined, "Tax increase would hit few small businesses." And it cites IRS statistics that say only 3% of small businesses would be hit by the tax. And it cites the Joint Committee on Taxation, which says 97% of all small business owners do not earn enough to be subject to the tax. Do you dispute those numbers?
Well, it's a difficult number to come up with when you talk about just how many businesses, small businesses, would be taxed in the top two brackets, because you're looking through IRS data, which is hard to dig through, because it's there's a lot of privacy involved with every tax return, so it's sometimes difficult to pull out one business from another as you determine how much income is one person earning from a business versus maybe their spouse has an income, maybe the spouse is a teacher and so they have income coming from a different source, but they file a joint return. So what we've done is we went out and asked business owners, how much income do you take out of the business? So we just went directly to the source, and what we found was that the overall number was higher. But what we also found was that the businesses that were most likely to be impacted were businesses that employ between 20 and 250 workers, and those businesses account for about a quarter of the overall American workforce. So the businesses that are most likely to be impacted account for a pretty substantial substantial portion of the American workforce, and especially in the current economic environment, are probably the businesses that are doing better. They have customers, they've got income coming into the business, and they're the ones that are most likely to be hiring and making investments. So while Washington has sort of been fixated on this argument of how many small businesses, what we think, well, you know, what our membership is telling us, and we are, you know, we represent over 350,000 small business owners across the country, and we're very much a membership-driven organization. They've been telling us, you know, don't raise taxes on anyone right now as we work our way through this recession. And, you know, especially when we start looking at those top two brackets, the, you know, we've been fixated on how many, but I think some of the question here should be which small businesses are likely to see their taxes go up. And that's been a part of the debate that's sort of been missing.
And you're saying it's those small businesses that tend to hire a lot of people?
Well, I think especially right now, you know, I mean, there's a couple of decisions you have to make when you're determining as a small business owner, am I going to hire a new worker? And first and foremost is, do I have work for that business owner to do? And if sales are down, and we've definitely seen that as a number one problem facing small business owners. We do a monthly survey of small businesses, and that has consistently, since the recession started, been the number one problem. Number two being uncertainty about the economy and uncertainty about policy changes. But, you know, do you have work for the business for that worker
employee,
to do,
yeah.
for that employee to do.
So let me follow that thread with you. Let's mm-hmm. say that a business owner makes $300,000 in taxable income. Mm-hmm. The tax bill would go up 3.5 points or about $10,000 mm-hmm. on the $300,000 income. Would that cause the owner to lay off an employee or not hire one if that employee does have work to do and is profitable for the business?
Well, I think that's going to vary from business to business, but it certainly isn't helpful that when we're attempting to increase investment or attempting to increase employment, and that business has that $10,000 that they could be using in a way to help increase the investment in their business, potentially increasing the hiring in their business, and then the money that they are spending helps the business that they're spending, sort of a ripple effect through the economy, that if that's being taken out, if that tax revenue is being taken out and coming to Washington and being spent in another way, you know, that's investment that's lost. And especially in the current economic climate, I don't think we really want to lose any dollar of investment coming out of these businesses or hindering those decisions that businesses are making. I think that's, you know, as we've seen yesterday in this poll that came from CNN, I think it was 7 of 10 economists said extend all of the expiring rates. And I believe it was Mark Zandi who said letting those rates expire would lead to a double dip recession. So, you know, I think it's important for Congress to provide some certainty going forward so the business owners know what their tax liability is. And they're not sort of, you know, stuck on the fence of saying, you know, am I going to have to pay $10,000 in more taxes next year, or can I make a new investment and buy a new piece of equipment or you know, or begin to make payments to the 401k plan again or whatever it is they may have had to cut as they're working their way through the last 2 years, which have been very difficult.
It's our election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Issue one, true or false, a tax on the wealthy is a tax on small business. We're talking to Bill Risch, tax counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business, a lobby group representing small businesses. We will get the other side of this argument from former Labor Secretary Robert Reich coming up. So it's Risch and Reich on a tax on the wealthy is a tax on small business. And we can take a few phone calls, any small business owners or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. The Times article on Saturday quoted what it said was much research over the last 20 years, which suggests that increases in the top tax rates can actually help cause the creation of new small businesses as wealthy individuals start businesses to avail themselves of the lower tax rates on businesses than on individuals. Do you disagree with that?
Well, you know, there's another study done a couple years back that talks about an increase in the individual rate leads to a 5% increase in individual rate leads to a reduction in investment by 10%. So, you know, I think some of these studies cut different ways, and I think you sort of have to look at them in the context of what's going on in the economy at that time. And, you know, I think right now, for small businesses in particular, as I mentioned, we do a monthly survey, and we've been at recessionary levels since basically September of 2000. 2008, and having a real hard time for small businesses to dig their way out of a really tough economic stretch. And so I think any kind of increase in taxes is going to be a disincentive for investment, especially in the current environment. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty among small business owners about their taxes, about their health care costs, about the cost of bringing on a new worker. There are a lot of changes that are coming down the line for small businesses. And for the small businesses that aren't doing as well, those have a particularly negative effect in terms of making decisions about investment and expansion of their businesses.
We don't have a lot of time for calls on this because we're having back-to-back guests, but let's take David in Norwalk. You're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Hello. Greetings. I used to have a small business, I find it confusing when I had an accountant who would come in at the end of the year and say, okay, now it's time to spend money. We need whatever you need for the business. It's time to go out and buy it for precisely this reason. You want to get the profit down, reinvest into the business to get into a better tax bracket. Doesn't that then create investment? If we have $30,000 extra in the business and we can go hire somebody, that's not profit. That's a business expense that comes out before profit.
Mr. Risch?
Sure. I mean that is certainly something that is certainly a way to do some tax planning is, you know, you get to the end of the year, are there investments you can make and can you reduce your taxable income by making those investments? And I think the question now becomes is a business going to be willing to make that choice to take on that investment regardless of what the tax situation is, or are they going to say, look, I don't want to spend that money now because I don't know what my liabilities are going to be next year. I don't know what my cost of doing business is going to be next year. So they make the decision to think on a longer term in terms of their investment rather than in the short term. So, you know, I think some of these decisions cut in a couple of different ways.
I kind of disagree. If you're going to, if $10,000 is going to go to the government, why not spend that money for the business instead of having it go to taxes? We had an accountant here in Connecticut. My ex's family had a firm in Texas, and they were very vehement about that kind of planning. So we were hiring an accountant. We were getting the services of a firm down in West Texas, and we were spending money before taxes, all of which is stimulus. Mm-hmm. So if the tax burden is higher and we see that threshold coming at us, we can plan for it and lower our tax burden and improve the economy, 1099 some employees, get buy a new vehicle instead of keeping the old clunker delivery van on the road.
David,
These are all things that stimulate the economy.
Thank you very much. One more response to David, Mr. Risch?
Like I said, I'm certainly not going to disagree on the tax planning side. There are opportunities out there to do that. Again, when we look at our survey of small businesses, and we've been doing this for 35 years, capital expenditures and the plans to make capital expenditures are at a 35-year low in our survey. So despite the tax planning opportunities out there, we just don't see businesses making those kind of investments. Part of the reason is businesses are telling us now is not the time for me to make these kind of investments for a whole variety of reasons. The economy, policy changes, you know, they're in a lot of ways sitting on their hands waiting to see what the future holds. And until we provide some of that certainty, until we know what the issues answers are going forward, I think businesses are going to continue to hold on to a little bit more capital if they have it.
Briefly, when you talk about certainty as the issue, if you were certain that the Bush tax cuts were going to expire, would that unleash money into investment?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, if you know your tax liability is going to be higher next year, you know you're going to be spending more in taxes. So the question then becomes is, do you plan for that this year? But then what's the impact that has next year as well? Because that's money that's going to be pulled out next year that's going to be lost that you're not making in terms of an investment. I think one of the issues of uncertainty has been, you know, we've known for a number of years now that, you know, January 1, 2011, all these tax rates go back up, including a number of other changes to the tax code that are very important to small business. All of this expires at the end of this year. And Congress has essentially, you know, done nothing to address it. It really hasn't even been until, I would say, the last, you know, maybe month that this issue has really become a point of political debate in Washington. I mean, there's been some, you know, there's some talk about it on the periphery, but really the first hearing on this issue was held in July in the Senate Finance Committee. So it's sort of been, you know, Congress knows this is coming and they've done nothing about it. And, you know, it's, you know, and the clock is ticking.
Bill Risch from the lobby group representing small businesses called the NFIB. We'll get to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich with another view of this in a couple of minutes. Before you go, the Democrats' position is that they are targeting tax breaks to small businesses specifically, rather than use the blunt instrument of these across-the-board cuts to wealthy individuals. That same Times article that you were quoted in notes, the Senate just passed a bill to offer $12 billion in tax breaks to encourage small business investment and create a $30 billion fund to encourage community banks to lend to modest-sized companies. So would that all not help your group's members more than the across-the-board lower rates for wealthy individuals?
Well, what we're hearing from our members is, first and foremost, is to extend the current rates. I mean, that's what we're hearing from our members to do. That doesn't mean what's in that bill was a problem. We said that the bill was good, that there were some good tax provisions in there that would help small business. But I think what really would have been helpful would have been to address a couple of these issues together. The expiration of the rates, the targeted tax provisions. There was an amendment that failed. There's a tax filing provision that was included in the health care bill, which places a tremendous new cost on small business and has had bipartisan support to be repealed. Unfortunately, it didn't get the 60 votes it needed in the Senate to get rid of it. I think doing some of those things and getting rid of some of the built-in cost of some of these programs we're seeing in the next couple of years would really help small businesses, because it would free up, it would provide some of that certainty that small businesses need. So, you know, some of the targeted tax breaks were good. There's some expensing provisions in there we think are helpful. There's a deduction relative to the self-employed purchasing health insurance. Those are two good tax provisions. But I think an approach that provides the certainty is broad for most small businesses, plus the targeted incentives that were in that bill, would have been a much better approach.
And just briefly, because I'm curious, on another issue, the health reform law, and we'll do this in more depth later in the 30 Issues in 30 Day series. But just for now, I know businesses don't want government to demand coverage or demand taxes, but in the global competitive environment that we're in, where almost all our competitor countries have universal government-supported care, does this not help small businesses to compete, especially if they're competing internationally?
Well, the concern we've had with the health care law, which we opposed, is that it's actually going to have the opposite effect and increase costs. So at the end of the day, we don't think that what was passed here in Washington is going to do anything to decrease the cost of health insurance. And that's the number one concern for small business owners. We think this is going to increase costs. The things like the tax credit that were provided for small business, we don't think are really going to be much of an incentive.
And would you have rather seen something like Medicare for All, which Robert Reich, our next guest, actually supports, because then the government takes it on and it's not your burden?
No, we've talked with our members and come up with some ideas that we think would have been helpful. For example, we worked on an amendment with Senator Wyden from Oregon and Senator Collins from Maine that would have provided a voucher for small business owners to be able to make a contribution to their employees to be able to buy health insurance. We think that would have been a much more effective way to go. Would have put the business and their employees a little bit in more control about what it is they're buying and what it is they want, and give a little bit more certainty about what the cost is that the employer's paying and what the employee's paying. We think an approach like that would have been the better way to go.
Bill Risch, tax counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business, a lobby group representing small businesses. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we'll get the other side of this from former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. And we have a 30 issues related quiz on our politics website. It's freecountry.org. The question is, do most economists believe that cutting tax rates actually produces more government revenue? Do most economists believe that cutting tax rates actually produces more government revenue? Go to itsafreecountry.org to take the quiz and see the answer. Robert Reich in a minute. Issues in 30 days. Issue number one, true or false, a tax on the wealthy is a tax on small business. We just heard an argument for that proposition. Now we'll hear the argument against from former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich, currently a professor at UC Berkeley, and this will be in the context of his new book called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Hi, Dr. Reich. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
In your opinion, would raising the income tax on people making $250,000 a year be a job-killing tax on many small businesses?
No. I mean, look, we're just going back to the rates that were under Bill Clinton. And under Bill Clinton, small businesses flourished. We had 22 million net new jobs created during those years. I mean, nobody who says that those tax rates were terrible for small business or terrible for business has a memory.
In the New York Times analysis of this on Saturday, it did say that few small businesses would be affected, but it also quoted trade groups that say if you exclude lobbyists and home-based businesses, almost 8% of businesses would be affected by the tax increase, responsible for nearly half of all business revenue generated in the country. And our previous guest from the NFIB said something similar.
Well, first of all, beyond the point I just made, this is just going back to the Clinton years, and which were pretty damn good years. The second point that a lot of these worriers have, but they don't really talk about it, is that we're only talking about the marginal income tax. That is, we're not talking about raising anybody's taxes under $250,000. It's just the portion of their taxes that are over $250,000. And besides, many of these so-called small businesses, if you look at them very closely, are not really small businesses at all. They are subchapter S corporations, LLPs. They are the kinds of things that basically financiers and lawyers set up. They don't generate a lot of jobs.
How much can you look at the Clinton years, which you've referenced twice now, and say, well, these were the tax rates that were in effect then, therefore these tax rates won't be a drag on business because it was a time of prosperity? I mean, so many other things were different in the economy that is it comparing apples and oranges?
Well, I think it's fair to say the larger point is that supply-side economics, which is based on the principle that if you lower taxes on top earners, will help build the economy because the benefits will trickle down to people in the middle, has been proven absolutely wrong over and over and over again. We had the Reagan and then the Bush tax cuts, and what happened to the middle class? Basically, what we've seen is that for 30 years, the median wage, adjusted for inflation, has gone nowhere. Families have done a little bit better, but that's mainly because, number one, women went into paid work, and secondly, everybody worked longer hours, and then thirdly, the final coping mechanism was that people went deeper and deeper into debt. But those are unsustainable coping mechanisms. And so we are left with the legacy of supply-side economics, which is essentially gigantic deficits in the future, and a middle class that is left high and dry.
You propose – well, you write in your book, Aftershock, that you ground your economic proposals in morality, that it's simply unfair for a handful of Americans to take home such a large share of total income. But the other side argues that that's a false choice, that pro-growth policies may make the rich more rich, but they also make the middle class more rich than raising taxes would, which slows down the economy and therefore hampers wage growth for everyone. Maybe that's the supply side argument you were just denouncing. But do you reject that idea out of hand?
I reject it historically. It just hasn't worked. I mean, they have to have some evidence. I mean, when you make a proposition having to do with the economy, presumably you have to have some evidence you point to justify what you are talking about. And by the way,
About the Clinton years, people will point to the Reagan years on the other side and say, well, he had all those tax cuts and there was a lot of prosperity after that.
Well, but beginning in the Reagan years, that's when male wages stopped growing. The median male wage in the United States today, adjusted for inflation, is below what it was in 1980. I mean, how can you say that we have succeeded with supply-side economics? By the way, Brian, I'm not calling for tax increases on the wealthy. That's not the centerpiece of my book. That's not the centerpiece of what I am suggesting. What I am calling for is a reorganization of the economy that will grow the middle class, that will widen the circle of prosperity, and help even people at the top on the principle that, and we've seen this in the post-war era, 30 years after the Second World War, a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy is better than a bigger share of an economy that's essentially dead in the water. And so wealthy people ought to be very much in favor of changes that reorganize the economy so more people can benefit. And therefore, the middle class has more purchasing power to turn around and buy the fruits of our economic growth.
That's trickle-up economics.
It's trickle-up economics. May I quote you on that?
I think I got it from you.
No.
But the previous guest quoted Mark Zandi from Moody'sEconomy.com, who's not known as a right-wing ideologue by any means, I don't think. And he was saying if the Bush tax cuts are allowed to expire, he predicts a double-dip recession as a result.
Well, the Bush tax cuts should not expire, in my view, for 98% of Americans. The bottom 98%. It's wrong to raise taxes, and that's essentially what you do by allowing them to expire, for the people who are desperately holding on right now, if at all. I mean, most Americans, this is not a recovery. You know, that news that we are suddenly, we suddenly learned that in June of 2009, the recession was over. What a joke.
Which came out yesterday, and which for me really calls into question the very definition of a recession. If it's only measured on that one thing, which is whether total GDP is expanding or contracting, it's so irrelevant in many, many ways to the actual human condition in the country that why don't we just define a recession by something else?
Well, we ought to really be defining a recession in terms of jobs and earnings. I mean, that's fundamentally what people care about. And it's not the jobs and earnings of people at the very top. They're doing fine. It's the jobs and earnings of people in the middle. So we ought to talk about median earnings, and we ought to talk about the joblessness or the rate of unemployment of the vast majority of people who are in the middle, and not even fool around with the official definition of unemployment, which does not include all of the people who are working part-time, who'd rather be working full-time, and the people who are too discouraged even to look for work, and the people who are holding onto their jobs because they've had to settle for lower wages and lower benefits. A lot of Americans, by the way. But getting back to your point, should the Bush tax cuts expire for people at the top 2%? Yes, because they are not the ones who are they save a much larger proportion of their income than everybody else. They're not going to spend the benefits of the Bush tax cuts. And if we're at all concerned about the future deficits of this country, why give the top 2% who already are taking home a larger share of the income than at any time in the last 40 years, why give them a windfall that is essentially $36 billion next year alone? $700 billion over the next 10 years. It makes no sense at all.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, my guest on WNYC, the second guest in our 30 Issues in 30 Days. Issue one today, which is a true-false proposition, a tax on the wealthy is a tax on small business. He's also got a brand-new book called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Our lines are full, and we're going to take some phone calls for you in just a minute. But you propose in the book not just the income tax hike on the wealthy, but a reverse income tax to supplement the wages of people making $50,000 or less. How would that work?
Well, very simply, we have right now something called the Earned Income Tax Credit for low-income people. This was the brainchild of Milton Friedman. This is not a terribly radical lefty idea. I'm suggesting that we expand the Earned Income Tax Credit right up to the middle class. People and families earning $55,000 a year should be getting some additional wage supplements instead of having withholding. And even people above them ought to have reduced income taxes. I think that that's the only way of strengthening the middle class in the short term. Over the long term, we've got to do a much better job with education, including early childhood education and access to higher education. But in the short term, we do that. We finance it by a slightly higher marginal income tax on people at the top and a carbon tax.
Is that enough to do all of that? And you're also proposing a reemployment system rather than an unemployment system, as you call it, which includes 90% of a laid-off worker's income for 2 years, rather than the current unemployment checks, which are much smaller. I know you're hoping that that time and that money would be used for retraining.
And if I can just interrupt you, Brian, also a key part of that reemployment system is that if somebody settles for a job that pays substantially less than the old job they had, that there is wage insurance that provides at least half of the difference for up to 2 years. That would enable people to pay their bills and get a new job, even if it pays less, and then hopefully get some training and therefore become more valuable.
And does all of this add up to revenue neutral when you look at the challenges that the government is facing with the retiring baby boomers and the implementation of more government health care coverage, which a lot of people don't believe will be deficit neutral, even though that's, you know, the official scoring? Can you add a reverse income tax for people making up to $50,000 and a 90% unemployment insurance compensation system and do all of those things and not increase taxes a tremendous amount?
Yes, if you have a carbon tax, you certainly can. And if you increase marginal income taxes on people at the very top very slightly, you absolutely can. I have the math in the book. I've done it, and I show people how it's done. But the most important point is if you do all of this and rebuild the middle class, you reignite economic growth, because you can't have any growth if the middle class can't afford to buy what the economy is capable of producing. And if you reignite growth, then you can deal with future deficits much more easily. If you don't reignite growth, then future deficits become a huge problem. Because remember, the issue is not the deficits themselves. The issue is the ratio of the debt or deficit to the entire economy.
Barbara in Stamford, you're on WNYC with Robert Reich. Hello.
Thanks so much for taking my call. This is really an honor. My husband is a small business owner, and his small business is he makes sales for sailboats. He profits from people who make a great deal of money, who have boats, can go yachting, can afford sails. That's always made us just a little queasy. But there's nothing that correlates to an increase in his business based on the Bush tax cuts. These people have money no matter what. And it's been disturbing to me that in the last few weeks I've spoken to several other acquaintances who also have small businesses, not necessarily in the sailmaking business, who are all saying, you know, business is just really down. We're really worried. We're suffering.
And are they all saying that if taxes go up on the top 2%, that that's going to make things better or at least not worse?
No way. No, it's not going to affect them at all. And then I was thinking yesterday after reading Paul Krugman's article, The Angry Rich, I worked for a small business between the mid-1980s and the mid-1990s, when things were pretty booming. The two managing partners made very, very handsome six-figure salaries. And the company paid for leases on luxury cars for them. You know, when things started going downhill, one partner retired and the other partner took $10,000 out of my defined benefit plan for his own use. And when I complained about that, his lawyer said, well, sue him. And I didn't want to go to the time nor trouble nor expense, but I thought, what a great example of white-collar crime.
Plus, it was probably legal, even though it sounds like it was really, really mean. Barbara, thank you for your call. By the way, I want to recalculate a number that I gave before that I think was inaccurate. I was giving an example of somebody who makes $300,000, if the Bush tax cuts were to expire, let's say they were in a couple, because of what you said earlier, that they would only expire on that portion over $250,000. Somebody who makes $300,000 with this 3 percentage point higher tax rate, I think it would only be about a $1,500 tax increase.
Very little. And I want to go back to what Barbara just said, because we have seen over the last 30 years, even as median wages for families have basically stagnated, adjusted for inflation, there has been an extraordinary increase in concentration of wealth and income at the very top. Brian, just to give you an example, in the late 1970s, the top 1% by income in the United States was bringing in about 9% of total income. But since then, things have concentrated more and more to the point where 2007, the top 1% brought in 23.5% of total income. So Barbara's point that a relatively small tax increase on income over $250,000 is not going to dramatically change the spending patterns of the rich is exactly right, because the rich have never had as much money. Last year, you have 25 top hedge fund managers who earned, on average, $1 billion each. Let me make sure that you understand what I just said. $1 billion each. $1 billion would pay the cost of 20,000 classroom teachers in the United States. Things have got so out of whack that it's hard to even conceive of what's going on.
Let me get one more caller in for you. Giovanni in Bed-Stuy, you're on WNYC. Hello. Right to the point.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I concur wholly with what the Secretary has said. He's made the historical argument going back to the Bush tax cuts well. Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah,
did you want to add something?
The other point that I think that is overlooked in this whole thing is that the more critical problem facing the people, and I used to own a small business, is not necessarily the impact of debt over a period of time, but the actual deficit, but the actual debt that we have now. The debt now approximates $13 trillion.
That's the federal government's debt.
Right. And that's approximately 3 times what we spend in a budget in a year. If our budget is $3 trillion. So unless we start thinking in terms of how we do something about the debt rather than mm-hmm. deficit.
So you need to generate some.
And the only way to attack that, and one of the ways to attack that, is to pursue the programs of taxing that top 3%.
Revenue as well as watching spending. Giovanni, thank you very much. Secretary Rice, before you go, 2 things really quick. One, you do have at least one proposal in the book that many conservatives will love. You embrace school vouchers. Briefly, how come?
But I say progressive vouchers. That is, the value of a school voucher is inversely related to family income. So if you are a poor family, you get, let's say, $15,000 voucher per kid. If you're a wealthy family, you get maybe a $3,000 voucher per kid. That will induce a lot of schools to try their best to get those $15,000 voucher kids to come on board.
And on the state level, Governor Christie in New Jersey is in the news here today for saying, despite his state's deficits and accumulated debt, he wants to substantially lower state income taxes because they are 9% in New Jersey, while they are 3% in Pennsylvania. And he sees New Jerseyans leaving for Pennsylvania, those very ones who have a lot of money and who can afford to move around. Is there any alternative to the race to the bottom at the state level?
Well, there is an alternative to the race to the bottom, and that is states in a region basically getting together and deciding through state compacts that they are going to keep taxes on the top about the same level that they are going to agree to in order to prevent just that kind of shopping, that kind of
And until that happens, does Christie have a point?
Yes. Christie does have a point. But let me also say what the states have been doing lately, that is raising sales taxes, property taxes, sin taxes, casinos. All of these tactics are very regressive because all of these kinds of taxes hit moderate income, lower middle income, and poor people much higher.
You don't like sin taxes. You don't like soda taxes, cigarette taxes.
Well, all of these taxes, you know, they sound good, but the point of fact is that they, again, they take a bigger bite out of the pocketbooks of average working people than they do out of anybody else.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Rice, currently teaching at UC Berkeley and author of the brand new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Mara on WNYC. That's our first 30 Issues in 30 Days segment. Tomorrow, issue 2, and so on, right up until the day before Election Day. We now start 30 consecutive weekdays leading right up until Election Day. And we have a debate starting on Thursday's issue on our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. Join that debate. It's about the true or false proposition that public employees get too many benefits. Go join that conversation and read what others have written. Robert Rice just waved his hands as if to say, ah, at itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehrer and WNYC.